This is day six of this March 2014 7-day session, and we'll take up a koan today. This is number three in the Mumonkan, gateless barrier, and it's called Gute Raises a Finger. And we'll just first start with a case. Whenever he was asked about Zen, Gute simply stuck up one finger. At one time, he had a young attendant whom a visitor asked, "What is the essential point of your master's teaching?" The boy also stuck up one finger. Hearing of this, Gute cut off his finger with a knife. As the boy ran out screaming with pain, Gute called to him. When the boy turned his head, Gute stuck up his finger. And at that, the boy was suddenly enlightened. When Gute was about to die, he said to the assembled monks, "I received this one finger Zen from Tenryu. I used it all my life, but could not exhaust it." When he had finished saying this, he died. Have a little information, biographical information about this Gute. First of all, he's a Chinese master, of course. Gute is the Japanized version of his Chinese name. Which is Jinhua. And he was one of the earlier masters. We don't have any dates on him, but say roughly the 9th century. Really, it's just one long entry here, one long story about him from which today's case was taken. When Jinhua first became the priest of a small temple, a Buddhist nun named Shiji visited him. Wearing her hat and grasping her staff, she walked around him three times and said, "If you can speak, I'll take off my hat." Now let's back it up here. And when he first became the priest of a small temple, presumably he was a monk, a celibate monk. I don't know why people use the word priest for celibate monks. But he was put in charge of a small temple. And we'll see just a little bit later in this story that he's probably put there. Or maybe he wasn't put there. Maybe he found, and we read about this sometimes, monks will find an abandoned temple and take up residence there. This Buddhist nun visited him. She was carrying her walking staff, which is a standard equipment for wandering nuns or monks. And she had one of these conical hats that we know from photos of monks in Japan. And she walked around him three times. This is a little ritual that we still here do in some of our ceremonies, a ritual of respect, of it's a courtesy, it's etiquette. So she goes that far in terms of respecting him, But then she says, if you can speak, I'll take off my hat. In other words, she's throwing down the gauntlet, and she's saying, give me a word. Give me a word of truth, a word of understanding, and only then will I take off my hat. I'll finish the etiquette and take off my hat. She did this three times. She walked around him three times. Again, she walked around, said that. She walked around three times, said it again, and then repeated it. But Jinhua said nothing. Well, as the story goes on, we can deduce that his silence was not a silence of understanding. He was stymied. She was offering a challenge, and he just sat there. No doubt his mind was racing. What do I say? What do I say? What do I say? Come on, come on. She gave him a second chance. Talk, come on, something. Then, so she began to leave. She could see that he was not ready for prime time. And then he said, hey, hold on, it's getting late. Why don't you stay here? And then she held fast. She said, say the right word and I'll stay. Again, he did not reply. And so she left. And after she left, he sighed and so said, though I inhabit the form of a human, I don't have a human spirit. It would be better if I left the temple and went traveling, seeking knowledge. So he was deflated. He could see that he had failed the test. And he was feeling pretty inadequate and thought, all right, my sitting here in my little hermitage hasn't really worked for a challenge like that, and I need to get out, back out into the world. Solitary sitting can be good for the right person at the right time, and it can also be a form of avoidance. Some people just do better alone. People who have trouble with others want to avoid conflict, want to avoid the friction that comes from living with others. This is one of the advantages of residential training, is this rubbing up against one another and having to accommodate others and learning to flow as called for. And that, which means, at times, letting go of one's stubborn opinions or ways. This is all potentially very, very good. We're not told how long Gute had been at that little temple. I called it a hermitage. Maybe it's not technically a hermitage. But he was living there alone, it sounds like. He may have been doing good zazen, just hadn't reached the point yet where he could respond to her challenge. Or he might have been just settling in and doing his... What did I say earlier in Sesshin? What we sometimes call Bonpu Zen, a safe and uneventful Zazen. Here's a story, a short story from this wonderful collection of stories called Stories of the Spirit, Stories of the Heart, Parables of the Spiritual Path from Around the World. And this was a story attributed to one of the desert fathers, one of the Christian desert fathers. And here's how it goes. A brother asked Abba Matthäus, "What shall I do? My tongue causes me trouble, and whenever I am among people, I cannot control it, and I condemn them in all their good deeds and contradict them. What, therefore, shall I do?" The old man answered him, "If you cannot control yourself, go away from people and live alone. For this is a weakness. Those who live together with others ought not to be square but round, in order to turn toward all." And then the old man again said, "I live alone, not because of my virtue, but rather because of my weakness. You see, those who live among people are the strong ones." There's a saying in Zen that the sage of the mountains or the desert is not the true sage. The true sage is the sage of the marketplace, just meaning human society, living among others, rubbing up against all different kinds of people, people who don't see you as anything to be impressed with, ornery people, argumentative people. This is where we really have our practice tested. And that would include living in a family, of course, working with others. So he resolved to pack up his things and leave in the morning. According to one account, he packed his bags, and it was still dark. It was still before dawn, so he did zazen, wanted to wait until the sun rose, and then a mountain spirit. According to the account, a mountain spirit appeared, let's call it a dream he was having, and advised him that he must not leave, for a great bodhisattva would appear in the flesh to teach him the Dharma. 10 days later, so he unpacked his things and he settled in. He took this really to heart, this vision he had. And then 10 days later, a master, Tianlong, his Japanese name is Tenryu, came to the temple. Jinhua received him and bowed, and then he told him the story of the nun and how he had failed her challenge, and that he felt he needed to leave his safe little solitary temple. And at that, Tianlong, Tenryu, simply held up one finger. And at that, Jinhua attained great enlightenment. As always, with these stories where one word or one sentence or one gesture triggers the enlightenment of another, we have to consider what went into that, what preceded that exchange, that encounter. You can be sure that after, in his state of shame, no doubt he was ashamed for having failed the test of this nun, that he had been turning inward and doing doing more zazen than ever, just to be able to have some rest from what would have been a critical dialogue going on in his mind, finding fault with himself. So maybe, or likely, he had used that time, those 10 days or after having that dream, to ramp up his sitting. And so by the time this tenu arrived, he was in a very promising state. His mind was empty. He was in a samadhi state, which is the precondition for awakening. And so he was ripe. It just took this one act by this tenryu of raising up his finger, and everything opened up for him. And then the story continues. It says, from that time forward, students came from everywhere, but Jinhua merely raised one finger and offered no other teaching. This is unusual to have just this one response that he gave to everyone who came to him. But there are a few other examples of that. There was a Zen master, Luzu, also early. In fact, he preceded Gute. Every time he saw a monk coming, he would face the wall, just turn and face the wall. Hakuin, of course, we have Hakuin asking what is the sound of one hand. He might also have asked what is the sound of one finger. Linchi Rinzai, known for his shout. Deshan Toksan, known for his use of the stick. Simple responses, elemental, fundamental. Although we've read teachings of Bankei where he talked quite a bit, he's known, other than that one text, he's known for responding to every person who came to him with just the single word, unborn. This is another word for this original nature of ours that is beyond birth and death. Unborn. Could have said undying. And now there's a boy living at Gute's temple, and each time he was asked by someone or some visitor, he held up one finger. He was imitating Gute. And someone told Gute, Master, the boy also understands the Buddha Dharma. Anytime someone asks him something, he holds up his finger just like the master. I see this as a provocative statement. unless it was a real, an awfully naive person who really believed that the boy understood the Buddha Dharma the way Gute did, that person was tattling on this boy for just imitating Gute. And then according to the story, and this, you know, is like so many of the things that happen in these koans, we can take this as a kind of a parable. One day, Gute concealed a knife in his sleeve and asked the boy, "I've heard that you understand the essential doctrine. Is that so?" The boy said, "Yes." Gute then asked him, "What is Buddha?" The boy held up one finger, and Gute grabbed the boy's finger and cut it off with a knife. The boy screamed and ran for the door. Now here, we get into two different versions of this story, both very interesting. We read ours: as the boy ran out screaming with pain, Gute called to him, and when the boy turned his head, Gute stuck up his finger, and the boy was suddenly enlightened. Here's the other version. As the boy ran away, Gute yelled at him. When the boy turned his head, Gute said, "What is Buddha?" The boy held up his hand, but his finger was gone and there was nothing there. The boy instantly was awakened. We can be sure that neither of these versions is literally true. Can't imagine a master with an attendant who'd been serving him literally cutting off his finger. Can take it symbolically, taking away from the boy his habit of imitating Gute. Depriving him of his crutch, his playing, just going by a gesture that he had no real understanding of, taking him out of his compassion, taking it away from him. This second version, the boy holding up his hand, but his finger was gone. There was nothing there. The key word in that account is nothing. Nothing there. He had it taken away from him. The boy, no doubt, made the silly mistake of thinking that it was the finger itself, not the gesture, not the spirit behind the raising of the finger, but the finger itself was it, the answer, demonstration of the truth. You know, we have this idea in Zen, this metaphor of words not themselves being the truth, but being like the finger pointing at the moon. It's the moon of our true nature that is the point. The finger is just pointing at it. This boy made the same mistake, seeing the finger as just a reference, as seeing the finger itself as the whole, and not realizing that it was much more than that. I can't read this koan without remembering the sight of children, toddlers, raising that index finger. It never gets old. For I always love to see that, especially the way they do it. It's like they don't even know they have an arm or a finger. They're just reaching unselfconsciously. They don't see the finger as an object separate from the rest of their body. When Guce was about to die, he said to the assembled monks, "I received this one-finger Zen from Tenryu. I used it all my life but could not exhaust it." And when he had finished saying this, he died. He would surely, if he had used it as often as we hear he did, then he would have seen, understood that that was much more than a finger. And that as such, it could not ever be exhausted. Like Hakuin's one hand, Lu Zhu's turning his back on the guest and facing the wall. It says when he had finished saying this, he died. But really, every time he had raised his finger, he was dying. Nobody there. Gone. In our daily activities, can we also never exhaust the routine things that we do? Washing our hands, inexhaustible. Standing up from our bed. Crossing our legs, inexhaustible. Nothing left. All, it's all there is at that moment. All there is in the whole universe. Now, Mumon's commentary. The origin of the enlightenment of Gute and the boy is not in the finger itself. If you really see through this, Tenryu, Gute, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with one skewer. Every koan, we could say, really can never be exhausted, truly. We can come to some understanding of it, but every single one is bottomless because it is just another formulation for our true nature. This mind that is unlimited, beyond anything we can say about it. Mu, the word mu, the koan mu, is not just a pointer. It's not just a reference. It is it. As long as we see mu as a means to an end, we will not be able to understand it. We have to make it the whole. See it for its own sake. Delve into it for its own sake. Not just the means. It is an end in itself. It is mind. It is our very nature, this mu. And it is an inexhaustible. The verse. Gute made a fool of old Tenryu. With a sharp knife he punished the boy. The mountain spirit raised his hand, and lo, with little effort, the thousand myriad piled mountain was split into two. Here Mumon is drawing from folklore, Chinese folklore at the time. This is some kind of a folk tale. You know, the Chinese language is so imprecise, so vague, that another translation of this verse is, instead of saying Gute made a fool of old Tenryu, it says Tenryu made a fool of Gute. The characters were probably something like Tenryu, fool, Gute. It's left to the reader to intuit subject and object. It's one of the things that makes these koans so fascinating, and the translations can be so different, because it is often a matter of interpretation. Either way, what could Mumon mean? How could Gute made a fool of Tenryu? How could Tenryu made a fool of Gute? And what about this punishing the boy with a sharp knife? Is that just a statement of fact? With a sharp knife he punished the boy? Or is Mumon trying to help us see beyond this? What really was going on there? And then this folk tale, the mountain spirit raised his hand, and lo, with little effort, the mountain was split into two. The great irony of Zen practice is it takes so much effort to get beyond effort. It takes so much effort to be able to let go and just surrender to mu, to the breath. to whatever our practice is. We work and work and work and work, and all in order to just open up, release and open up. That is all the more likely to happen at this late stage of Sesshin. This is day 6, tomorrow is day 7. All the work that has been done, people have been doing up to now, has all prepared us, opened us, ripened us for what's possible. And anything is possible now. Do not doubt it. With faith in this practice, total faith, you can become the practice itself. It's no longer us working on it. It's not even we go beyond it working on us. We become it. And we understand it. Roshi used to quote someone, he never said who was talking about relationships and said, in order to to understand anyone or anything, you have to love him or it. But once you love it, him or her, you don't need to understand it. In Zen, we talk about becoming one with, which is really the basis, the underlying, the well of love is becoming one with. We stand our best chance now to reach that final merging with the practice. And in that merging comes a different kind of understanding than subject-object understanding. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.